This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. When the state legislature abolished the death penalty in 2012, they left it in place for the 11 men already on death row. It was the result of a political compromise stemming from the public reaction to the brutal 2007 murders in a home invasion in Cheshire. Governor Daniel Malloy said that it should be clear that the death penalty for those murders would be carried out. But in a gubernatorial debate in 2010, his opponent, Tom Foley, said he and most others knew that probably wasn't going to happen.
He has said that it wouldn't apply to the criminals who perpetrated this crime. But in fact, it would. And even if it's specifically excluded them, they'd have a very solid case for not having the death penalty apply to them.
Last week, the Connecticut State Supreme Court went even further, striking down the death penalty altogether as unconstitutional. Lawrence Goodhart, professor of history at UConn and author of The Solemn Sentence of Death, was cited by justices.
This is just the logical culmination of 400 years of an atrocious, arbitrary, capricious process.
The decision made national headlines. Even Republican presidential candidate and U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham weighed in. He was focusing on the Cheshire home invaders when speaking with radio host Michael Medved.
You know, what kind of legal training have they had? What kind of upbringing has allowed them to arrive at the conclusion that those two people killing them through a judicial system that imposes the death penalty somehow makes us an indecent society?
Those two people, those are some key words that we'll be looking at throughout the course of today's Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. We're doing a law and order version of the Wheelhouse today to focus on this case and many of the other important things that face the Connecticut judicial branch. We don't spend a whole lot of time talking about the judicial branch because there's so much fun to be had at the state capitol. But today, with this very important decision just a week old, we're going to be bringing in a few experts. As always, I'm joined by Colin McEnroe. He is the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Welcome back, Colin. Good to see you.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Also joining us is Dan Clough. He's counsel at McElroy, Deutsch, Mulvaney & Carpenter and blogs at appealinglybrief.com. Did I have all that right, Dan?
You've got it all right, John.
Good to see you once again.
Thanks for having me.
And David McGuire is here. He's legislative and policy director for the ACLU of Connecticut. Good to see you, David.
Thanks for having me.
So, Colin, I'm going to start with you, and I also want to give out the phone number, 860-275-7266, if people want to join our conversation. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. We talked about why we're doing the Wheelhouse a little bit differently. Obviously, this is a very, very important decision that requires an awful lot of conversation. But I think a real case that you made is that we just don't spend enough time talking about this branch of government, certainly not the Supreme Court.
And by we, I would say I mean kind of everybody in the Connecticut press. I mean, the decisions like this one for the mainstream press, I'm not talking about blogs like Dan's or Norm Pattis's or Gideon or things like that, but the mainstream press, we almost start from square one. It's kind of like there isn't somebody who's really imbued with a lot of knowledge about this. There are still some people who cover the courts, but I mean, for you'd have to go back to Lynn Tuohy. Lynn Tuohy was probably the last reporter on a nearly full time basis looking at the judiciary system. She was a reporter for the Hartford Courant. She did a fabulous job at that. But for the most part, we don't know that much about them. Nobody really specializes in them. And then if you spread that out to the general public, it gets even more extreme. I heard a story over the weekend, which I completely believe, about from a friend about a high-ranking legislator who was decrying the latest decision and saying, and it was 5-4, whereupon this legislator had to be told that there are only 7 voting justices on these decisions. And he went, oh, yeah, of course, of course, of course. But I think he's not alone in that boat. I mean, I think a lot of people in Connecticut could not name more than 1 or 2 state Supreme Court justices, if any, and don't really have much of a command of this because it's just not a very publicly scrutinized process.
You know, and we recently did a program with a few legal scholars about the U.S. Supreme Court, and that's something that's different, Colin. I mean, maybe years ago we didn't know as much about the U.S. Supreme Court justices, but now with some tell-all books and a lot of time in the press, getting a chance to get more audio recordings, more than just Nina Totenberg reading us transcripts of what happens in the court. It seems as though those nine people we know a little bit, but you're right, we don't know anything about the seven who voted here or the eight who serve in the Supreme Court.
Right, the nine at the federal level, I mean, it's almost to the point where there's like Tops trading cards for them, and now, you know, but I mean, down here, not so much.
Well, okay, so why is that? Before we get into the particulars of this case, Dan, I guess I'm just wondering from your perspective why it is that this most important branch of government that we rely on so heavily for important decisions like this seems to be something that is just so opaque to most Connecticut citizens.
Well, you know, I think it was Hamilton who described the judicial branch, the federal judicial branch in this case, as the least dangerous branch.
He sang it, too. We now know that.
That's true. He did in hip-hop, in hip-hop rhyme. So, you know, by design, although it's one of the three branches of government, true at the state level, it is the least dangerous branch. It doesn't have the power to declare war, doesn't have the power to set taxes. Judges are supposed to go about their business rather quietly, behind the scenes, except when they render a decision and then they explain themselves. So in the absence of some kind of criminal controversy involving a judge, the business is generally routine, and all you get is coverage of a discrete decision that prompts people's interest, like the one we're going to talk about today.
And do you think that in any way, David, might change over time? I mean, when we have a major case like this, now we've got, you know, I don't know, Lindsey Graham saying something nationally. I don't know how high a public profile he has right now, but Lindsey Graham saying something on a national talk show about the Connecticut Supreme Court and questioning their ruling here. At a certain point, should we be paying more attention to this body?
I mean, I think it's important to pay attention to this body, but like Colin said, there's really not the coverage that you get of other issues at the executive or legislative level. You know, part of it is the only regular reporting done on this is from the Law Tribune, Connecticut Law Tribune, which is a trade paper that's read by very few insiders, the lawyers. So if there's a way to break it down in a way that a lot of U.S. Supreme Court blogs do to make it in English, plain English, that'd be great. I just don't know if our press corps has the resources to do that.
So let's focus on this decision. And Colin, I'll go to you first to maybe set up some of this. And in those cuts that we were playing, including the one from Lindsey Graham and an awful lot of the conversation that has been had after this, you would think that the case that was heard by the U.S. Supreme Court that we're talking about here was actually about the Cheshire home invasions. It was about Stephen Hayes and Joshua Komisarzewski. But indeed, it wasn't. It was an entirely different case.
Yeah, it's a 15-year-old case. Case involved a guy who was paid by with a snowmobile to kill somebody who was the boyfriend of a woman who was coveted by the guy who was exchanging the snowmobile. So, as murder cases go, this is kind of a low rent, but you know, in its own way, a very ugly one. I'll just comment quickly on those
Sure.
three cuts because they're all really interesting. I don't say this very often, but Tom Foley was right. Tom Foley was right, even to the point of really there was, I think, kind of a conspiracy of willed ignorance on the part of a lot of the people participating in the abolition of the death penalty, ranging from Governor Malloy to the legislators. They knew at some level that, in fact, that nobody was ever going to be executed in the state of Connecticut, no matter how prospectively they worded this legislation. They knew that. And in fact, this is the case nationwide. In other words, in no state that has abolished the death penalty was anybody ever retroactively executed. It just doesn't happen. So they were kind of pretending and waving to various people who had, you know, really heavily vested interests, starting with the survivors, of some of these murder victims. You know, oh yes, we're really not going to disturb that in any way. Well, I mean, at some level, they knew nobody was ever going to be executed again. I mean, that's just the reality. Just quickly, the
sure.
other two people, Lawrence Goodhart's an interesting figure in all this. I mean, a mild-mannered scholar. He's been on your show. He's been on my show. He wrote a terrific book about the death penalty. It's not typical that mild-mannered historians wind up getting cited so much in landmark opinions, but clearly Dick Palmer discovered this book. And I mean, it does make several very interesting cases, ranging from the fact that our standards for the death penalty have shifted over 400 years. In other words, it's not as though we have hewed to the same standard all the time. Our standards for the death penalty are mutable. So at a certain point, we like delisted adultery, for example, as a reason to put somebody to death. So we don't always have the same standard, but to the extent that we do do have standards, they have fallen hard or harder on racial minorities and other marginalized groups. Two kind of important things. The first one probably more important to the logic of Palmer's opinion. Last quick thing about Lindsey Graham. Whenever anybody says this, I think they are kind of revealing the racial bias part of this. I mean, in Connecticut for the last 10 years, there's kind of been one murder case that anybody knows anything about. It's the Pettit murder case. It's a horrible murder. I don't mean to diminish its horror at all. It's a horrible murder case. But there are other horrible murder cases. I mean, a lot of the other people on death row are really appalling people. Russell Peeler, responsible for the death of B.J. Brown, a little boy who could have been a witness against him. I mean, if you're going to abolish the death penalty, you are retroactively going to be looking at some really dreadful people who are not named Hayes and Komisarzewski, and you're going to be looking into the future at some other horrible people who are going to come along later. To focus on the Pettit case and to always only talk about that, it really does kind of point up the fact that we place a higher value on white, affluent, well-connected victims than we do on other kinds of victims. And that, of course, is one of the arguments embedded more probably in the concurrence in this case than in Palmer's opinion. But it's part of the whole argument.
And I want to actually get more deeply into the racial component of this, because that's an important part of the national conversation about the death penalty and also about our criminal justice system in just a moment. But I want to put this idea to you, Dan Clow. When Colin says Tom Foley was right about something, again, doesn't happen too often, sort of a Haley's Comet moment for us that Tom Foley was right in Colin's mind. But indeed, Tom Foley and a lot of other people at the time that the legislature passed this prospective law, myself included, said there is no way in hell anyone ever gets put to death here in the state. Did you see it the same way at the time?
I speak in terms of probabilities. In other words, there was no way that anybody in 2012 when the law was being passed could say with a certainty that the state Supreme Court would find that the death penalty is unconstitutional under all circumstances. And the fact that we have a 4-3 decision that we're looking at last week proves that. But we could talk about our probabilities and likelihoods. And I think everybody appreciated or ought to have appreciated that there was a significant risk that the Supreme Court would say it's not enough or it's unconstitutional to only repeal this on a prospective basis.
And again, something to just remind people, Colin, the death penalty repeal actually got very, very far in the state legislature 1 year before. But because of the Cheshire case, essentially lawmakers backed off. And then the political compromise the following year was indeed this prospective law.
Yeah. So it's actually sort of a three-step thing. In 2009, the legislature repealed the death penalty. Jody Rell wouldn't sign it. Then the year before that, yes, very specifically because of the Cheshire case, and two legislators in particular stood out, Andy Maynard and Edith Prague, who had both pretty much, you know, come forth in the past as, you know, as vehement and unambivalent opponents of the death penalty, said because of their meetings with Dr. Pettit and because of this whole case, they just couldn't do it, which struck me as bizarre. I mean, it's bizarre because, in fact, the other people on death row are also heinous people. I'm opposed to the death penalty, and I understand that being opposed to the death penalty means that heinous people are not going to be executed, not just Hayes and Komisarzewski, but a whole bunch of them over there. And it also embodies this fallacy that going forward, there will never be anybody as horrible as Hayes and Komisarzewski. There will never be another murder as horrible as the Pettit murder. And as Dan says, there are no certainties in life. I can pretty well guarantee you there will be, though. You know, there will be other cases every bit as appalling. You know, it might be 15 years from now, 30 years from now. I hope there won't be many. But they will exist. And so to suggest that this case is sui generis is, I think, a little intellectually, you know, disingenuous.
And if you want to join us, 860-275-7266, and we're going to get to some of your calls in just a moment. I want to go to Dan Clow and David McGuire, though, and just talk through, in your respective opinions, how you feel the legal merits of the 2012 prospective law held up and what you see in this decision, this 4-3 decision by the court. I'll ask you first, David, to weigh in on this. What do you see as the reality of that 2012 law even holding up as it was? And what did you hear from the court here?
Well, I mean, I think when that 2012 law did pass, and I was part of the public that was lobbying for its passage, people recognized that it would be challenged. I think everyone knew, like Colin said, that it would likely never result in someone being executed. But I think there was a lot of uncertainty as to how the Supreme Court would come out. Ultimately, you know, I think that the argument was made and a majority of the justices agreed that when the legislature weighed in on the prospective abolition, they were essentially saying this doesn't work. This, for many different reasons, does not comport with our society's ideals here in Connecticut. So, you know, I think that the legislature was signaling something, and that the courts picked up on it, that this is no longer a valid way to punish people in Connecticut.
Dan?
Well, so the legislature struck, you can call it a Faustian bargain, I suppose, but it was one of the most difficult legislative compromises that we've seen in recent years. The only way that the proponents of abolition of the death penalty could get a law was to agree to leave it in place for the folks who were on death row. And the question that was before the Supreme Court was really this: should we, the justices, respect that very difficult legislative compromise that was made? Or is there some concrete constitutional basis for saying not only can't you make that compromise, but having done so, you have abolished the death penalty entirely? That's what the fight was really about between the four majority justices and the three concurring justices.
And what do you make of the concurring justices? What do you make of this 4-3 opinion, Dan?
So I want to be careful here, because anything I say, my own personal opinion, is going to make four people very angry and three people very happy. And those are the people I make my living in front of. So let me put it this way.
By the way, you just gave away your bias.
That's true. I did. Although I should say, just for the record, I'm an opponent of the death penalty, both on policy grounds and constitutional grounds. But that wasn't the specific question in this case. What makes the dissenting justices' opinion so powerful are two things. First, I think the Chief Justice really eviscerates the reasoning of the majority opinion. She dismantles the arguments in a very effective way. Second, what the dissenting justices accuse the majority of doing is not simply rendering an opinion that the dissenters disagree with, but of usurping the legislative power, of abandoning their role as judges and simply substituting their own personal moral views. That is the accusation that all three dissenting justices make. They are saying to the four majority, you are not acting as judges. You're acting as a super legislator, and that is a completely improper thing for judges to do.
Chief Justice Rogers, amongst other things, writes, the majority's decision to strike down the death penalty in its entirety is a judicial invalidation without constitutional basis of the political will of the people. It is the usurpation of the legislative power, not the death penalty, that violates the societal mores of the state as expressed in its fundamental law. What do you say, David?
Well, I mean, it's pretty clear here that the justices, even though they were sitting on this case and writing it for over 2 years, did draw from a recent case from the U.S. Supreme Court. That was the Oklahoma lethal injection case. And they drew off dissents from Justice Ginsburg and Breyer. And I think they did reach a bit, perhaps, in getting where they wanted to get, but their legal analysis was sound. And the fundamentals are there. This is not a fair punishment.
Colin?
A couple of quick things. Well, first of all, I mean, let's be clear. Their job is to rule on constitutionality more than legislative intent. If they feel as though the constitutional argument trumps legislative intent, that's where they're – I mean, I'm the only one here who didn't go to law school, but that's the way I understand what the Supreme Court
does. I didn't
go
to law school either.
Yeah. So, you know, so if in fact they feel that there's a compelling constitutional argument against the legislation and against the legislative intent, they're allowed to go there, and that's sort of the argument that they construct. It's also kind of interesting. This problem is not confined to Connecticut. It's sitting around in all kinds of places, and it has been dealt with differently in all kinds of places. So in Illinois and Maryland, they had basically the same problem: abolition of the death penalty, people on death row. The governor's basically – O'Malley walking out the door, I think, just commuted all the death row sentences. Illinois governor did the same thing at the time of passage. In New Mexico, they are looking at this exact problem right now. Their abolition law is older. I think it's 2009. They've still got two people on death row, and they're wondering, what do you do with these people? And I think also one of the things when some of the Justice Palmer's recent opinions, they often look like opinions about what they are about, but also kind of blueprints for looking at this kind of thing in a broader way. And I wouldn't be surprised at all to hear that people in New Mexico, particularly advocates for the two people on death row in New Mexico, are looking at this opinion. And although it's specific to the Connecticut state constitution, there may be some arguments embedded in it that could be used elsewhere.
We're going to take a break. Actually, when we come back, there's a lot to talk about whether or not societal mores have really changed, about whether or not Connecticut residents support or reject the death penalty themselves. We'll also be talking more about the racial components of this. The Wheelhouse takes a law and order turn. We're taking a look at the Supreme Court ruling on the death penalty and also about our judicial branch with Colin McEnroe, with Dan Clow, with David McGuire, and with you when we return, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable, but we're taking a law and order look at The Wheelhouse today. We're bringing in Dan Clow, who's counsel at McElroy, Deutsch, Mulvaney & Carpenter. He blogs at appealinglybrief.com. He's joined us in the past to talk about legal issues here. David McGuire also joins us. He's legislative and policy director for the ACLU of Connecticut. Colin McEnroe, as always, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Before we move on, Colin, I would love to know what's on your show today.
On our show today is the New Yorker cartoonist Roz Chast. Those of us, she's exactly my age. We're born about a month apart, both only children, so I feel very bonded to her. But I think people of a certain age who grew up with her cartoons in the New Yorker about neurosis, about fear, have a certain kind of, ambivalent love for her. I mean, she sort of exposes our worst nightmares, but in a very funny way.
That should be a lot of fun. Roz Chast on the Colin McEnroe Show this afternoon at 1 o'clock. Today in the program, we are taking a look at the state Supreme Court, the judicial system in Connecticut, and we're going to be diving in even a little bit more to the ruling that they made last week on the death penalty in Connecticut. I want to go quickly to the phone, though. Hector is calling from Glastonbury. Hello, Hector.
Hi. Thank you for having me on. I'm not a lawyer, first of all, so you have to keep that in mind. Secondly, I'm not going to touch the death penalty because I have my own personal opinion. I'm calling more because you were talking about the judicial branch in general and how it interacts with the legislature. In the last 2 years, I've watched the Judiciary Committee in action, and everything, a lot of things you've said on your show, like the judges making some rulings which seem to overstep their authority in writing statutes, writing law. I've seen that. A great case is the Karuba versus Moskowitz. They gave GALs immunity in family cases, whereas the legislature gave GALs immunity in juvenile cases, but they never gave it. So that was like one. There's other examples, but I'm just giving that as an example.
And when you say GALs, guardians ad litem, that's an issue that we've actually talked about on the program and has been actually quite an issue during the last legislative session. So in part, Hector, I want to actually just get a little bit of a reaction here from our panelists. A part of what Hector's saying has to do with the crossover between the judicial branch and the legislative branch. And actually, in some ways, Colin, gets back to something I want to ask about in this death penalty case as well. But any thoughts on Hector?
First of all, the one thing that I would say is that the phenomenon that he's describing right now, and that, which he clearly takes part, has been remarkable to watch. I mean, there is this gigantic, digitally interconnected group of people who are very unhappy with the family court system, really unhappy with the family court system. And in fact, one of the stands that they made in the last legislative session was a stand against the reconfirmation of Chase Rogers as Supreme Court Justice, which then turned into a pretty ugly confrontation between Minnie Gonzalez and I think Representative Rabimbus. It's in a way, to me, it's like a separate thing. You know, it exists a little bit away from all the stuff that we're talking about. These are people who are embroiled in horrible family disputes. Their feelings are ratcheted up to a fever pitch, and they're just very unhappy with how the system works. And yeah, Chase Rogers sits on top of that system. I'm not sure exactly how well connected all that stuff is to the rest of the processes that we'll be talking about today.
Yes, but I mean, I think one of the differences is when we talk about a U.S. Supreme Court that we know an awful lot about and a state Supreme Court we don't know very much about, I think many of us were confused at least at bringing in Chief Justice Rogers into this controversy. Essentially, it was around a reconfirmation, and it didn't have a lot, Dan Clough, to do with her. But unlike the U.S. Supreme Court, she does sort of sit at the top of a judicial system, and so she's accountable in a different way than, say, Chief Justice Roberts at the U.S. Supreme Court would be.
Well, it's a sort of captain of the ship theory, and what Colin has been talking about is a small group of highly emotionally charged people who deal with a very specific type of case in family court. These are what are called high conflict cases where you have parents, often unrepresented by counsel, who are fighting over custody issues, and they're terribly difficult to deal with, but they represent a very small proportion. But they've gotten a disproportionate amount of media attention. And as you said, and as Colin was saying, the Chief Justice sort of got caught in the middle of this solely by virtue of the fact that she's the Chief Justice. She has nothing to do specifically with the resolution of these individual cases at the family court level. Those are handled by judges. But certain legislatures wanted to make a point.
I want to bring it back to the Supreme Court case on the death penalty here, and there's a lot of questions we have yet to get to, including in one of the dissents, Justice Carmen Espinosa wrote that the legislature could actually act to bring back capital punishment in Connecticut. Is that likely at all, David McGuire?
I don't think so. I mean, there might be a push made by some legislators this session to create some hoopla around it, but I don't think there's any real momentum there.
Senator Gary Winfield is tweeting at us, as he often does. He says, some of us who led the fight acknowledged the possibility, and again, that was the leading the fight to abolish the death penalty at first. That does not mean, he writes, that we didn't intend it as we passed it. He continues, having a death penalty with aggravating and mitigating factors means that some very heinous cases may not end in the death penalty. You can tweet us, of course, at Where We Live. This question of whether or not legislators would act to bring back capital punishment in Connecticut, Colin, it gets to one of the things that is written about in the concurring opinion here, which has to do with whether or not the death penalty is something that we support as a state. You would think by reading the 4-3 decision that indeed Connecticut is strongly against, in public opinion, the death penalty as it stands. But most polling that we've seen over the course of the last few years post-Cheshire suggests otherwise.
Right. Just to go back to Gary's point for a second, Representative Holder's point, one of the things that's kind of interesting about Justice Palmer's opinion is that he goes back and looks at some of the testimony that was given by members of the sort of prosecution branch of the judiciary. So Kevin Kane and I think the Criminal Justice Division, they did say if this law passes, there will be no more executions. It's a fiction. That's actually a word that they use and Justice Palmer cites. It's a fiction. The prospective restrictions on this this legislation are a fiction. So if you want to know somebody who told the public the way that it was all going to spell out, it turns out that in opposing this law, Kevin Kane and the rest of his staff basically did sort of reveal what was going to happen. Okay, I forget what you asked.
I was asking about whether or not legislators are going to – whether or not this is actually going to be up in front of the legislature, I highly doubt. But the fact is that it seems as though the majority of Connecticut residents in most polls that we've seen actually support the death penalty. They do not reject the death penalty, as perhaps the concurring opinion might suggest.
All right. So I have more admiration for the Palmer opinion than I think Dan probably does. But I will say I think maybe one of the little weak joints in it is actually one of the more quoted parts of it, and that's the dinosaur comet part of it. So basically what they say at this point is we don't really need to prove that public opinion is overwhelmingly against the death penalty. We need to prove that it's trending in that direction. And then the analogy they use is a gradual extinction of dinosaurs isn't that different in this context from a comet that just hits them and wipes them all out at the same time. So because, in fact, as you suggest, looking just at public opinion, it's not where you might think it was at reading the decision. Although I will say that public opinion polls are kind of weird. Depends on how they're worded. Whenever you give people the option of life without parole, the number changes. If you just say, are you opposed to the death penalty or not, or you know whatever, then you know it tilts one way. But it'll often almost reverse itself if you give people the option of life without parole. Then they go, oh, well, yeah, that's fine too. That's fine with me. So and in terms of whether there's legislative will to do this, the legislators don't like pain, you know? I mean, they don't like pain that they have to go through. So the birthing process of this particular law was painful enough. They got it done. It's now upheld and effectively expanded by a state Supreme Court decision. They're not going back there, as one of our other two guests said. Maybe there's a small cohort that might want to bring it up, but no, they're not going back there.
Well, so there's two interesting questions. I tend to agree with Colin that the likelihood, and David as well, that the likelihood of a legislative response to the decision is minimal. I wouldn't be at all surprised if certain folks, led by folks like Senator Fasano, for example, try to continue to make use it as a wedge issue in elections. But I don't see a likely legislative response that upsets this. But there's a fascinating debate between the majority opinion and Justice Espinoza in particular about whether it's even possible for the legislature to overcome this. Justice Palmer, in a footnote, says the only way that this opinion can be challenged is by amending the state constitution. Whereas Justice Espinoza says, no, if the legislature passed the Public Act, they can repeal the Public Act, and that would be a reflection of contemporary standards. So I find that a very interesting debate. I'm still unsettled about who's right. But
David, I'd love you to weigh in on this, because the amount to which public opinion and shifting public opinion over time, maybe not just years but decades, how legally that can weigh in to a Supreme Court decision like this.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that the majority was very, very smart in how they parsed that and talked about the evolving standards. The reality is the legislature, as well as the courts, do look to the public's, you know, standards of decency, what they think is right. I mean, legislators, because they want to get reelected, the courts, because they're trying to use it as reasoning to figure out whether something is within those contemporary standards of decency. You know, the polling on this particular issue is so volatile, because like Colin said, one awful crime can change the entire landscape. So I think that the courts, you know, took that snapshot and used it as they needed to get that job done.
I know that you wanted to talk about a law that I didn't know was a law, Dan. I mean, the law of unintended consequences is something we cite often, but I don't know where it is in statute.
I think it's somewhere under 1-2Z sub F, something like that. But here's a concern. I had this hypothetical question I always wanted to put to the four majority justices. The question is this. Let's say you're a state somewhere else in the union that is considering abolishing the death penalty. You face the same difficulties that the Connecticut legislature did in terms of assembling a number of votes to abolish it entirely, all right? And you're trying to come up with a compromise. The question I have is, does this decision by the Connecticut Supreme Court make it more difficult for other states to gradually repeal the death penalty? If that's the direction people want to move or states want to move, and I applaud that entirely and support it, does this decision actually make it harder? Because now the people who are against prospective can say, if you do this, everybody on death row presently death penalty will be abolished for them. So I think that there could be an unfortunate, unintended consequence of this decision, which makes it difficult for other states to do the same thing.
But the reality is most states, the governor has that power to commute a sentence. I think there's only two other states other than Connecticut where the governor does not have that discretion. So I think you're right. I mean, I think on balance, though, this does help courts around the country and advocates kind of grapple with this issue and come out with the decision of abolition. It sets a really, really great blueprint. And that socioeconomic and racial disparity argument is fleshed out in such great depth. And in Palmer's opinion, I think that's really going to be cited by a lot of courts.
And I want to get to that next. But I mean, just to this point of, you know, in states where the governor can commute sentences, I mean, that's a political third rail. I'm sure a lot of governors don't really want to deal with to begin with. What do you make of Dan's unintended consequences, Colin?
I think it would be a better argument if it weren't for the fact that, I mean, in fact, Connecticut lived through this exact process. In other words, Connecticut, looking at the experience of other states, knew, and it's just there in all the testimony and all the debate that led up to the passage of our abolition law, that in the experience of other states, it amounted to nullification of the death penalty. So, and then Connecticut, knowing that, knowing based on the experience of everywhere else, did its own abolition. To me, that kind of suggests that states, they're going to do what they're going to do, and sometimes they'll wave a flag to a certain constituents and say, we're doing it prospectively, we're not going to violate our implied promise to survivors of victims of these homicides. But in fact, I mean, everybody already knows that this is the way it goes.
I want to get to one more quick phone call. John's in Simsbury. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's up?
I just wanted to put a point out here. I think this is, I mean, I don't think it's that important of a decision because it's a moot point. The last person who was executed was Michael Ross, I believe, and he basically asked to have all of his appeals stopped. So unless you ask to be executed, I don't think there was any chance that in Connecticut, at least, that anyone was going to be executed.
And you make a very good point. And Dan Clow, not only that, did Michael Ross essentially volunteer to be executed, but he was the first to be put to death in Connecticut or in New England, actually, in quite some time before that.
Yeah, I mean, Joseph Mad Dog Taborsky, I think in 1960, mm-hmm. was the last time Connecticut had executed somebody. So practically speaking, the death penalty has been virtually unenforceable in this state. And I think the caller is absolutely right that absent a death row inmate voluntarily giving up all appellate rights, actual executions would have been exceedingly unlikely.
But the reality was it was racking up tremendous costs in terms of the defense and the endless appeals, and then also tying the Department of Corrections' hands in terms of how to treat and care for these offenders.
Which is a great point. I just have to touch on that because, you know, the dissent says that's really what the 12-5, the Public Act, was about. It was about a recognition that the implementation of the death penalty was so costly because of the, you know, it takes 20 years of appeals, that was their principal motivation. Of course, the majority disagrees with that, and there was great debate.
Yeah, I thought the majority's disagreement with that was pretty effective, though. I mean, basically, they went back and looked at testimony of legislators. And they're, look, if you're a legislator and you feel that this is politically problematic, you're better off doing what Chase Rogers said that they did, which is make a practical argument. We can't get this done. It costs millions of dollars. We should just stop. It doesn't work. And what the legislators who talked about this said on the record was, you know, even Republican conservative guys like John Kissel and people like that. So they have a moral problem with this. They have a moral problem. So I thought in refuting Rogers's dissent that the majority, you know, made a pretty persuasive argument that this wasn't the basis for the repeal. I mean, not the only basis. I'm not saying it wasn't a consideration, but it certainly wasn't the only basis, that the moral argument against the death penalty was, you know, uppermost in their minds.
And we've touched on this in the last couple minutes before our break. We need to talk about this important piece of it. Justice Palmer writes in this opinion, social scientists repeatedly have confirmed that the risk of capital punishment falls disproportionately on people of color and other disadvantaged groups. This is an argument long made by death penalty opponents, Colin, and it makes its way into this Connecticut decision.
Yeah, and actually, you know, one of the really interesting studies of this originated with a guy who I think was on faculty on Trinity College for a while and now is out at Stanford, a guy named John Donahue, who studied the Connecticut death penalty and looked at the way that it was applied. And I mean, his main finding is one of kind of arbitrariness, he tried to do kind of a mathematical regression and control for variables and then sort of look when the death penalty was applied and when it wasn't, and found that it was, A, pretty arbitrary and capricious, like who got the death penalty and who didn't, but that as you looked at variables, yeah, black offender, white victim is, you know, just rises to the top right away.
David?
Well, out of the 11 people that were on death row before this opinion came down, six of them were black, and that's 10% of the population in Connecticut. So just there you see there's this huge disparity. And then again, what district they were in when they committed that crime also has a huge role in deciding whether they got the death penalty or not. So really, it wasn't the worst of the worst.
And what do you think of this piece of the decision, Dan?
I think this piece of the decision is very powerful and had absolutely nothing to do with this particular case, which is another issue that the dissent has. So I agree completely. And if I were sitting on the U.S. Supreme Court, I think that it is impossible to apply the death penalty in a non-arbitrary, racially indifferent way. Okay?
Yeah.
But the study that that Colin cited in Connecticut, the Donahue study, is a very controversial study. There are opposing experts. The judge in Connecticut, Sam Sferaza, ruled that it was not persuasive. So relying on that report is very questionable for the court.
We got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to find out a little bit more about how our judicial system works outside the state Supreme Court. And we'll also get to know your state Supreme Court justices. Since we don't know anything about them, we'll try to learn more with Dan Clough, with David McGuire, and with our own Colin McEnroe here on Where We Live on The Wheelhouse. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Tomorrow on the show, food trucks might have been thought of as a fad for a few years, but they're still going, serving pizza, tacos, grilled cheese, cupcakes, a lot more. It's not just some hipster fantasy either. Food trucks actually serve a lot of people real food every day. We'll also explore why some towns want to keep food trucks out. That's on tomorrow's show. Today on the program, it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. Colin McEnroe, as always, joins us, along with Dan Clough, who writes the blog appealinglybrief.com, David McGuire from the ACLU of Connecticut. We've been talking about the state Supreme Court. Just very quickly, I want to get, Colin, to the idea of Governor Malloy's Second Chance Society is something that we've talked a lot about on the program. Something that I think the judicial system plays a big role in is, if you're going to do this, this isn't just a top-down, the governor says, we're going to change the way we do sentencing, we're going to change the way we deal with criminals who've been in and out of the system. This really requires an awful lot of buy-in from the judicial branch as well to make for a Second Chance Society across Connecticut.
Right, and we're having, and we'll continue to have, a fascinating national conversation about our criminal justice system, and expect bail reform to be like the next big thing that people are really going to talk about, needs to be talked about. But there, you know, back to Dan's love, unintended consequences. One of the amusing unintended consequences is that the Governor Malloy, who really kind of has emerged philosophically as a leader in this notion of a second chance society, of reforming this process, of doing something about hyper-incarceration, perhaps in the spirit of diversity, appointed Justice Carmen Espinosa, who I'm not convinced believes in first chances, and never mind second chances. She is a prosecutor at heart. She is, no matter how many judicial robes you put on her, she is still a prosecutor. She, for the most part, doesn't like criminal defenders very much. She doesn't like decisions that favor criminal defendants very much. So it's just, you know, it's just one of those things.
We've certainly heard an awful lot from people on this program before, David, talking about prosecutorial overreach. I mean, maybe it extends into that too, not just to the bench, but how prosecutors actually decide to go after people and what sort of sentences they seek for people maybe who have drug convictions, for instance.
They do. I mean, the prosecutor is the most important person in that trinity at the courthouse between the judge, the defendant, and the prosecutor. The prosecutor runs the show, essentially. And like Colin said, I think the bail system is really what needs to be looked at. Bail is used and gives prosecutors a tremendous amount of leverage. There's no two ways about it. Of the 93,000 cases handled at the Part B docket of the criminal court last year, that's the main area of cases, only 97 went to trial. So, I mean, most of these cases are being dealt with by plea bargains, and it's a real problem. Justice is not being done. So we expect some real good discussions at the legislature about bail reform.
I completely agree with David's comments about bail reform, but the other issue that we need to continue to look at is plea bargaining. I mean, it is prosecutors routinely present criminal defendants with draconian choices. They overcharge and say to the defendant, well, we'll give you a cut, you know, a reduction if you'll plead. Now, the prosecutors and the judges who sit on the criminal docket often say, no, we're not putting a tax on going to trial. We're just giving you a discount if you plead. But when 90-some-odd percent of the cases are done through plea bargaining, that's where we have to place some serious attention.
And I'll just say one other piece of a first chance society is making sure that we have legal assistance for defendants who can't afford it. There's been a legal aid funding crisis for years, David, and I think this is something we probably need to address at some level as well.
Absolutely. I mean, what you need to do is have more cases progress naturally through the system. Then you need to have competent counsel representing defendants, and that's a big problem that we have here.
I just want to go back to what David said, too. The prosecutor is, like, the most important person in all this. And there are places in America now where prosecutors are starting to see hyper-incarceration as a problem and starting to see it as their job to make this system run better, better in the sense of not keeping all kinds of people held either without trial or – I mean, there are prosecutors are starting to see that light. But it's a very, very hard evolution. I'll quickly say that the guy who wrote this death penalty decision, Richard Palmer, is a former state and federal prosecutor. Mm-hmm. And we never said this today, but the biggest thing that happened here was that Richard Palmer, like Harry Blackmun before him, changed on the death penalty. His thinking evolved on the death penalty. He's on the other side of the Ross verdict at the Supreme Court level and a bunch of other death penalty decisions. Mm-hmm. But here, a little bit later in life, not that Dick's getting that much older, but he's seeing things in a different way.
Well, we're learning just a little bit there, but in the last few minutes we have, let's play a game. We had quiz music last week. Let's play a game, Get to Know Your Supreme Court Justices. Hey, Colin, I'm going to let you take this away. I know you've got some questions for our panelists
here. Okay, yeah, lightning round real fast. Some of these will be pretty easy for you, I think. Which Connecticut Supreme Court Justice was an All-American in squash?
Dick Palmer.
Yeah, that was Richard Palmer at Trinity.
At Trinity.
What does a T in Chase T. Rogers stand for?
Tiberius. Oh, no, that's Kirk.
That's a good one.
It's Theodora. Which one of the state Supreme Court justices is a martial arts master who could kill you with three fingers if he needed to?
I have no idea.
Maybe Zarala? I could see him doing a karate job.
It would be actually the newest Justice Robinson, who I believe at they do a retreat every year, all the not just the Supremes, but all the judges in the state. And I think he breaks boards and stuff like that.
Wow.
And,
little,
anyway, he's very good at it. He's a martial arts master.
Into oral argument.
Which one takes Patriots' losses very, very hard?
Oh, that's got to be Zarella.
Yeah, Zarella. I've been told he almost can, you know, he can barely function after a loss.
Right.
Which one was a very accomplished equestrian in her? I gave that away, actually.
Chief Justice. In fact, I think she went to scholarship at Stanford on her equestrian.
And that's prowess. Right. That is correct. Last one. Who rode crew in college? That one is also Zarella.
It's hard to tell with the robes on.
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
That was Zarella, too. I think you rode for Northeastern.
There you go.
That's pretty good. So they knew some of them. I thought that they'd know all these.
They're not the most exciting people in the world. It was really hard.
But I still
find
think
these things.
I still think it was a pretty good quiz. Hey, Dan, before we're out of time, we got to hear some new music from you. You've got a brand new album coming out.
I do, and I really appreciate you asking me about it, John. It's called The Lawyer is a Tramp. Champ. It's my second album in 11 years, and it's in the mode of Tom Lehrer. So it's the classic American songbook, Rodgers and Hart, where I rewrite the lyrics to poke fun at the practice of law. It's the way I avoid paying $300 an hour to a therapist. So.
Well, we've got a little bit queued up. We have a track here called Sue Me. Can you tell me about Sue Me just before we hear a little bit of it, Dan?
Oh, right. So great song from the 60s, Hold Me, Kiss Me, Thrill Me, rewritten from the perspective of a person who has, Munchausen syndrome. Wants pain inflicted upon them.
This is an incredibly high-concept song by Dan Clow.
Sue me, sue me, Mr. Lawyer, send that pleading to me, how I want to feel it when you screw me, do it to me, please don't make me wait. Do it now, let the fun begin. Depose me, ask me questions long and hard.
You were just saying, Colin, this actually would play really well on CTN, right?
CTN needs a variety show. I mean, they've got a blockbuster killer lineup of programming, but they don't only have that sort of Ed Sullivan-type variety show or something like that. I could see Dan in kind of a Steve Allen role maybe, you know, something like that. I guess I'm dating myself.
Next song of the summer, I think, right here.
I know, the song of the summer. David, do you have a new record coming out this summer at all?
No, I'm working on some concerts.
Shut Up and Rule, I think, is the...
Let me just add, all proceeds from the sale will go on sale next month. All proceeds from the first 30-day of sales go to legal aid organizations in Connecticut, and 25% of the proceeds for the rest of the year go to legal aid in Connecticut.
So it brings it back to legal aid, and that's a very good thing to hear about. Dan Clow, counsel at McElroy, Deutsch, Mulvaney, and Carpenter, blogs at appealinglybrief.com, and he's got a brand new record coming out.
I'm pirating it. I'm not paying for it.
The lawyer is a champ. Thanks so much for being here, Dan. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, John.
Thanks also to David McGuire. He's Legislative and Policy Director for the ACLU in Connecticut. David, thanks very much.
Thanks a lot.
And thanks to our own Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WMPR. Thank you, Colin.
It was a delight.
Thank you to CTN, the Connecticut Network, who brought their cameras in today to film today's program for future broadcast. Our show produced by Lydia Brown, Tucker Ives, Betsy Kaplan, and Josh Nalea. Our technical producer is Kion Wolf. The digital editor is Heather Brandon. The executive producer of Where We Live is Katie Tularsky. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Where We Live.
After all, no one really wants to be sued. But then the feeling soon became overwhelming. And now I dream all day and night of lawyers who are shrewd. So sue me, in personam jurisdiction to me, collateral estoppel it right through me, do it to me, please don't make me wait, do it now.